Welcome to Cut and Thrust, your podcast for the bloody and sometimes bizarre journey through the Middle Ages. Whether it's dark battles, questionable hygiene, or hair-raising rulers, here you'll get history as it really was, raw and unfiltered. So grab your sword, put on your helmet, and let's dive into the wild world of the past.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of the Battle Merchant Podcast. I'm Hendrik.
And I'm Carmen. Today, we're diving into the world of medieval cuisine. And I say right off the bat, this is going to be surprisingly different from what you might expect.
Absolutely, because medieval cuisine was far more than just eating. It was about status, medicine, and an entire worldview.
And the crazy thing is, back then, people didn't simply eat what tasted good. A knight's diet, in particular, was closely monitored.
Exactly. For wealthy nobles, the cook often worked closely with a physician. The two were essentially a team, though this was more of a luxury than the standard practice.
So basically, they had their own nutritionist, except he also checked their pulse.
Something like that. And the reasoning behind it was the so-called four humors theory, humoral pathology. This was the foundational medical concept of the Middle Ages.
For those unfamiliar with it, the idea was that four humors circulate in the body: blood, phlegm, yellow bile, and black bile. And health meant keeping these humors in balance.
And now here's the fascinating part for the kitchen. Every food was categorized according to specific properties: hot or cold, moist or dry.
That sounds abstract at first. But in concrete terms, it meant things like plums were considered cold and moist. Spices, on the other hand, were warm and dry.
And the goal was to balance these opposites. They called it, how would we say it today? Kind of like...
tempering. That's actually what they called it.
Exactly. Thanks. Tempering. So combining warm, dry foods with cold, moist ones. To keep the body in balance.
What I find fascinating is, this wasn't just theory. They really put it into practice. Peppered dishes were considered warming and appetite-stimulating, though courses were structured differently than today. Multiple dishes of each course were served simultaneously, and the first course often included fresh fruits as appetite stimulants.
And it was even tailored to the individual diner. A choleric person, someone with too much yellow bile, too fiery, was given cooling foods. A melancholic needed warming ones.
So, personalized nutrition. Sounds almost modern, doesn't it?
Yes and no. The approach was, of course, well, not scientifically sound by today's standards. We now know these humors don't actually exist. But the fundamental idea, that nutrition and health are connected, was absolutely right.
And for a knight, this was existential. He had to be fit for combat. You couldn't just eat whatever you felt like.
Diet was carefully monitored to maintain fighting ability. That took priority over everything.
Which also explains why the cook and physician worked so closely together. The physician essentially made the diagnosis. What temperament does the knight currently have? What does his body need? And the cook then implemented it.
A well-coordinated team. And some medieval cookery manuscripts even included dietary guidance, which ingredients had which properties. Alongside these, there were separate dietetic treatises with even more details.
So there was an entire system behind it. Not just recipes, but almost medical instructions.
And it was also a status symbol. Only those who could afford both a physician and a good cook had access to this personalized nutrition.
Which brings us directly to our next point, because status played a huge role in medieval eating. Not just in preparation, but also in the ingredients themselves. Status in food. That's a massive topic in the Middle Ages. And nowhere is it more evident than with bread.
The daily bread that everyone ate?
Yes, but not the same bread. There were huge differences. The upper class ate white bread, made from finely ground spelt or wheat flour. Sifted multiple times, the bran completely removed. Nice and light, nice and soft.
And the peasants?
They had barley bread, rye bread, oat bread, coarsely ground, with bran in it, sometimes even with weed seeds or husk remnants. Dense, dark bread. Or often, no bread at all, just grain porridge.
That fits the picture. The refined goods for the refined people.
And here's the paradox. The coarse peasant bread actually had more fiber and nutrients than the fine white bread by today's standards. Although the peasant diet overall was often meager and monotonous, so it wasn't universally healthier.
Oh, that's interesting. So the status symbol was actually the less healthy option?
That's right. White bread is nutrient poor and fiber poor. Not fewer calories, but less filling. All those fibers, the minerals, they're in the bran, which was sifted out.
It's almost ironic. At least when it comes to bread, the poor ate healthier than the rich.
Though they certainly didn't see it that way. For them, coarse bread was simply poor man's bread, full stop. It was about status, not nutritional value.
And status was also demonstrated through the amount of processing. The more labor that went into a food, the more valuable it was considered.
There were also different gradations. So oat bread was the lowest, then came barley, then
rye, and then wheat at the top?
More or less, yes. It varied regionally, but white bread from wheat or spelt was definitely the crown.
And in a knightly household, was the bread baked on site?
Knightly households often had their own ovens. Fresh bread was baked regularly there. And then there's this legend. The lord of the manor always got the first slice, specifically from the upper crust. This isn't historically verified. It's probably a 19th century invention to explain the English expression upper crust for the elite.
Oh, really? That's just the legend?
Yes. The legend is so catchy because it fits so well with the image of strict hierarchy. But the real social distinction was in the quality of the bread, not in a piece of the crust.
Bread as a, how should I put it, almost like a social map.
That captures it. Who got which bread and which piece, that showed your place in the hierarchy. White bread for the lords, dark bread for the servants.
And yet, from a modern perspective, the servants would have been better off, at least nutrition-wise.
From a pure nutrient perspective, yes. At least as far as bread goes. More fiber, more minerals. With meat and fish, it was similar, depending on the season and fasting periods.
Though there were other status symbols in food, right? Not just bread.
Of course. Spices, for example. We'll get to those. But also the quantity and variety of dishes, and how they were served. At a banquet, it wasn't just about what was on the table, but also how it was presented.
We eat with our eyes first, even in the Middle Ages.
Absolutely. Refined dishes symbolized wealth and social standing. And that went far beyond simply filling one's stomach.
Now we're coming to a topic that personally fascinates me. Spices. In the Middle Ages, these weren't just about flavor. They were actual currency.
And they served a dual purpose. Spices were simultaneously status symbols and medicine. The boundaries between kitchen and apothecary were fluid.
Right. Nutmeg and cardamom. These were highly prized commodities. They came via trade routes from Asia, through Arab merchants, via Venice to northern Europe. A long journey.
And the longer the journey, the more expensive?
Naturally. Take saffron, for example. This was a spice of such high status, they called it red gold. A quarter pound was worth the equivalent of 2 dozen chickens. Counterfeiting was sometimes even punishable by death. And if you convert that into the working hours of an ordinary person...
It was practically unaffordable for common people.
Exactly. And sugar? That was also a spice, not an everyday sweetener like today. Its extraction required enormous physical effort. Sugarcane had to be harvested and processed by hand. That made it one of the most expensive spices of all.
And then there were the so-called grains of paradise. In medieval thinking, these were associated with the Garden of Eden, with luxury and ease.
They came from West Africa, from the Guinea region. Small brown seeds with a flavor somewhere between pepper and cardamom. The name alone, grains of paradise, shows what status they held.
And who had access to these precious spices in a household?
That was strictly regulated. They were stored under lock and key, in chests or...
In sealed clay pots.
Yes, or cloth pouches. Access was reserved for the head of household or the steward. Secured against theft because these items were so valuable.
That also explains why status determined the variety and quantity of spices used in cooking. The richer, the more spices.
And preparing these spices was the task of an experienced cook. Often a man, incidentally. This wasn't work for beginners.
But what I'm also curious about, what did a meal actually look like? Was it like today with appetizer, main course, dessert?
Not at all. The modern concept appetizer, main course, dessert didn't exist. Instead, dishes were served in multiple services. With each service, many different dishes came to the table simultaneously.
So basically a big buffet?
More or less. Guests could help themselves in any order they liked from the dishes currently on the table. Meat, fish, sweet, sour, all mixed together.
That also explains those sweet dishes served at medieval feasts. Spiced wine with pears, for example. That stood right next to the roast.
And these sweet dishes contained a blend of cinnamon, cloves, nutmeg and... What was it called again? Mace, the nutmeg flower.
All together, no separation between sweet and savory.
Unusual for us today, but completely normal back then. The spices were meant to complement the flavors of the food, while simultaneously adding a sophisticated touch.
And then there were the delicacies. Rabbit, for instance, was highly sought after among the nobility. They were either hunted or kept in special warrens.
That was practical, because you had fresh meat whenever you needed it. Hunting wasn't always possible or successful.
So, almost like a form of food storage?
Living food storage, yes. The rabbit was only slaughtered when needed. You couldn't get any fresher.
This whole interweaving of cuisine and, well, health practices, status symbols, practical considerations. It's really fascinating.
And you can see it with the cooks themselves. They were real stars. Bishops and kings would poach talented cooks from each other.
So celebrity chefs already existed in the Middle Ages?
Absolutely. Just without the TV shows.
Another aspect that makes this era so tangible is table manners and cutlery. That was truly a world of its own.
The fork, for example. That wasn't common, was it?
In medieval England, forks were actually considered foreign and unpleasant. People knew about them from Italy, from Byzantium, but here in Northern Europe, they were viewed with suspicion. Too exotic.
Interesting. So people ate with their fingers?
With the right hand, yes. And with the knife. The knife was the most important piece of cutlery. Food was speared with it and brought to the mouth.
That also explains why personal knives were so important. People carried them on their person.
And now, a quick word from our sponsor. Feeling curious? Then head over to battlemerchant.com. They've got all sorts of medieval stuff, from costumes to armor and loads more. Totally worth a look.
And not just the knife.
At banquets, guests usually brought their own cutlery. At major courts, however, it might also be provided.
So only at the major courts, otherwise everyone brought their own?
Well, at some courts there might have been ceremonial cutlery, but that was distributed according to rank, not simply given to every guest. Normally, you brought your own knife, that was important. In a sort of, what do you call it, cutlery case? Sheath?
An eating set, it was sometimes called.
Right. These leather pouches were often about 15 to 25 centimeters long, worn on the belt. Inside were the knife, spoon. Travel sets sometimes even included a cup, but in everyday life, the cup was usually carried separately.
So essentially the medieval EDC kit.
Something like that. Everyone carried their own. The German word Besteck for cutlery originally even referred to the case itself, what the utensils were stuck into.
But why specifically the right hand for eating?
That had to do with notions of cleanliness. The left hand was reserved for...
For personal hygiene?
Exactly. The right hand was the clean hand, the public hand. You ate with it, you greeted with it. That was strictly separated.
That makes sense for an era without running water and modern hygiene.
And this separation was reflected in the entire banquet etiquette. Strict rules applied at medieval feasts, not just for the food itself.
What kind of rules?
The proper distance between guests was prescribed. Conversation was to be kept subdued. People spoke quietly, not loudly all at once. The whole thing had an almost ceremonial quality.
And what happened if you didn't follow the rules?
There could definitely be consequences. You risked being moved to the lower end of the table, sometimes even among the servants, where you'd only get the simpler dishes. That was quite humiliating.
To the lower end of the table? That's almost worse.
There you only got the leftovers. While those at the head of the table ate the best portions, the punished sat at the back and had to take what was left.
That's almost elegantly cruel. No being thrown out, but maximum humiliation.
And everyone could see it. That was the terrible part. At a banquet where status was everything, suddenly sitting with the servants.
That explains why table manners were taken so seriously. It was about more than politeness.
It was about your place in society. Anyone who didn't know or follow the rules was showing they didn't belong.
And in a society where your social standing determined everything, what you ate, where you sat, what cutlery you had.
Everything was deliberate. Nothing was left to chance. Even whether you used a fork or not said something about you.
To close, here's a detail that surprised me. Claret.
The spiced wine?
Exactly. When we hear claret today, we think of dark red Bordeaux wine. But in the Middle Ages, it was something completely different. It was a very light, rosé-colored wine made through brief fermentation on the skins. The name comes from claret, meaning clear or light.
So light. Almost like a rosé. That's really unexpected.
The wine was enriched with a whole array of spices. As with the food, these were meant to complement the flavors of the meal, creating a taste bridge between dish and drink.
That's a concept we've almost lost today. Wine with food, yes, but this deliberate coordination of spices.
Though our modern mulled wine is actually a...
legacy of that.
Yes. Cinnamon, cloves, cardamom in warm wine, that comes directly from this tradition.
Looking back at everything we've discussed, medieval cuisine really was a fascinating blend.
Taste, status and health, all in one. Among the wealthy, cook and physician worked together. Spices were medicine and luxury goods at once. Even where you sat and what you ate showed your place in society.
And the paradox of it all. Although some of us today might prefer the simpler peasant fare, as a knight, that would have been a social faux pas.
That shows how completely social constraints permeated every aspect of life, right down to the plate.
This interweaving of cuisine, health, and society, that's what makes this topic so fascinating. It's never just about food.
And with that, we've reached the end of our journey through medieval dining culture. I hope you enjoyed it as much as we did.
If this topic interested you, feel free to visit battlemerchant.com. On the blog, you'll find many more fascinating articles for history enthusiasts.
Until next time.
Take care.
And so we ride towards the end of this episode. Keep your swords sharp and your mugs full. We'll catch you in the next one.